Welcome to Lou Marks The Spot, brought to you by yours truly, Lou Marks, bringing sanity and common sense back to America. Today, let's talk about Ibogaine. What is Ibogaine? The only true addiction interrupter, or not? The story I want to share here is just a little bit shocking, or at least it was to me. It makes one question the most basic assumptions commonly held about how rational science and modern medicine operate. To find out that a substance like Ibogaine can go through all this scrutiny and still end up far from the hands of those who need it. Here's the story of how Ibogaine possibly almost cured addiction in America. To begin, I must introduce our main character, a little known shrub native to Western Africa, mostly Gabon, a small country in Africa, and Cameroon. It's called Tabernathy Iboga. Legend has it that the Pygmies first discovered the magical powers of the Iboga root, which is powerfully hallucinogenic. It's actually a psychoactive substance. The Pygmies are said to have taught this knowledge to others, eventually becoming the practice of the Bwidi, a spiritual tradition that revolves around the use of Iboga. Bwidi belief is animistic, and Iboga is used to contact the spirits and the ancestors, as well as to heal the sick. Bwidi revolves around a three-day initiation into manhood, in which the initiate consumes huge amounts of this revolting tasting bark. In Gabon, Iboga is seen as a sacred medicine, sometimes referred to as the holy wood. Each community has a chief healer who is responsible for leading ceremonies of initiation of young men into adulthood, as well as other healing ceremonies. Iboga has been used as a sacrament by the Bwidi for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. In 1864, a French doctor is the first Westerner to discover the root and bring it to France, where a botanist names it Tabernathy Iboga, as is often done. He gave the plant his initials, because clearly he discovered it, even though African people have been using it intentionally for eons, possibly thousands of years. But it's not until 1901 that two French scientists extract the easiest alkaloid. Iboga has many alkaloids, 5, 6, 7, maybe more, to produce from the plant and name it Ibogaine. Ibogaine then goes through several manifestations as a prescription drug in America to combat fatigue in low doses, which remains on the market until Ibogaine is eventually banned in the United States in the 1960s. The large pharmaceutical laboratories show no interest either, between the fact that Ibogaine comes from a plant, so any patent can only be for its applications, which makes it pretty much financially useless to them, and the fact that it is a Schedule I illegal substance, getting Ibogaine to market would mean a lot of investment for a relatively small return. As an example, the official response from pharmaceutical company Ciba was, "While the indication for narcotic addiction withdrawals is almost certainly worthwhile, it has not been identified as a strategic commitment for our company." So in other words, even though it's worthwhile, it's not strategic enough, which means financially profitable enough. In the meantime, the CIA had been doing secret research with Ibogaine and other various hallucinogens. It's not long before scientists get the hunch that these substances may have an impact on opiate addiction. At the Federal Narcotics Hospital in Kentucky, a Dr. Harris Isabel, working for the CIA, conducted experiments with LSD and Ibogaine on African-American prisoners addicted to heroin. They used low doses, however, where psychological effects are significant, but not usually enough to interrupt addiction. The CIA would later neither confirm nor deny that they discovered the anti-addictive properties of Ibogaine, which I'm sure they did. In 1956, the researcher Schneider discovered that Ibogaine amplifies the effects of opiates, allowing one to take half as much for the same effect. But this research is also kept under wraps and secret until the 1980s. In the 1960s again, a few intrepid psychonautic explorers try Ibogaine. At that time, little known and in limited supply, it was also of interest to very few people. It lacked the sensory attractions and kaleidoscope effects like LSD, and involving more physical side effects such as intense nausea, vomiting. Even Allen Ginsberg and Timothy Leary weren't interested, because it wasn't euphoric like the other psychedelics, such as LSD. Finally, there was a young man named Howard Lotsoff, a heroin addict. He was offered ibogaine by a chemist friend, who says, "Try this, my friend. It's a 36-hour trip." Lotsoff, as I said, who was a heroin addict, was completely freed from his heroin addiction by a one-time ingestion of ibogaine in a matter of hours. Lotsoff then passes it on to another friend who calls him a week later to tell him that since he took it, he's miraculously experienced zero cravings for any drug that had been previously part of his day-to-day experience. And so it begins. Lotsoff in New York goes through the difficult process of procuring more ibogaine and organizes the first informal group trials. In the first group, 5 of the 7 volunteers who are regular drug users all stop drug usage for 6 months following treatment, a one-time treatment in a matter of hours. The other 2 go back to it. When Lotsoff asks why, they reply, "Because we're junkies. We like being junkies." There, he learned the importance of a strong desire to quit becomes clear, and ibogaine is an addiction interrupter, but its power is only as strong as their intentions. But it can be powerful. As Lotsoff explains, "I don't know if you know anything about heroin addiction, but one of the people that it worked on was a roommate of the other 2 that it didn't work on. He was living with those guys for 6 months while they were shooting up every day, and he wasn't using. Now, if you know anything about heroin addiction, you know how hard that is. So we knew we had something very unique here." Which is true. One of the main reasons why addicts, whether they use ibogaine, do it cold turkey, go to 12-step programs, AA, NA, return to addiction, is because they go back to the same environment and around the same people. And the worst is to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a husband or a wife, a spouse or siblings that are using and being around them. This is almost a sure guarantee of failure. Minimizing withdrawals, even the heaviest heroin addicts find themselves clean and withdrawal-free within a few days, sometimes overnight, or as I said, sometimes in a matter of hours. Gone are not only the withdrawals, but the cravings as well. To a junkie, an addict, this seemed like a true miracle drug, which to them it was. Lotsoff now goes to Holland and comes back from Holland with the first HIV-positive patient treated with ibogaine. He had been doing underground treatments. She had been addicted to heroin and methadone. Post-treatment, she is clean, and her disease, HIV, is even in remission. This earns the group ACT UP and ibogaine a lot of press. In June 1991, Lotsoff makes contact with a researcher named Dr. Deborah Mash at the University of Miami, who wants to conduct clinical research on ibogaine. It just so happened she was married to a high-ranking Democrat who had Hillary Clinton's ear. Clinton promises to do something about ibogaine once her husband takes office. So Dr. Mash drafts the first phase of trials and receives FDA approval. Amazing. The first human experiments with ibogaine were done in Holland, the only country at the time to have a real policy for the prevention of drug addiction. At the same time, research with Dr. Stanley Glick back in the United States shows that ibogaine will reduce self-administration of morphine in rats, which is very promising. On a side note, Dr. Suzanne Kapendiek from the Netherlands has done the definitive study, they would call it, on ibogaine and cocaine addiction in rats. She had 100% success on cocaine addiction and heroin addiction, both in rats. And that usually goes back to what we were just talking about, is that where ibogaine can do that, the rats had no friends to go back to, no thoughts about it, no psychological problems. So they were basically cured. Well, anyway, ibogaine finally gets its chance in the post-Reagan AIDS era due to the growing call for harm reduction. Harm reduction calls for prevention, safe sex, destigmatization of HIV-positive people, development of treatment, needle exchange, and for the therapeutic use of cannabis. ACT UP, which is a large direct Action Advocacy Group learns how to work at the lobbying process and gets required media attention at the same time, gradually gaining some influence in the political sphere. Dana Beale joins their ranks, a well-known yuppie at the time and was credited for being one of the starters of the yuppie movement. And those in the U.S. harm reduction struggle against AIDS now take on the Ibogaine cause as well. Unfortunately, there are some huge stumbling blocks for Ibogaine. Before scientists can conduct research on classified substances, they must get permission from both the Drug Enforcement Agency, which is the DEA, and the National Institute of Drug Abuse, NIDA. Scheduled substances face a lot of stigma and ostracizing, and most respectable scientists don't want to be associated with this kind of research. Dr. Glick's team of researchers do an Ibogaine study at the same time, demonstrating the real effectiveness of Ibogaine. Unfortunately, this won't be published until 1991, a year after Dr. Jaffe's research is published due to low funding and government interference. In the meantime, resistance at NIDA and the ARC starts to build. While ACT UP's efforts managed to get Ibogaine on NIDA's list of medications to be evaluated for the treatment of addiction, NIDA simultaneously opposes any clinical trials and bans even pre- and post-treatment evaluations, saying they could be seen as a tacit approval by NIDA. This would prove to be NIDA's modus operandi, claiming to be working towards Ibogaine research, but sabotaging it all the way. A new study of 40 treatments emerges from Holland. In the study, 25% of addicts gave up hard drugs for good after a single few-hour treatment. Another 25% found it worked to keep them sober for at least a month. An additional 15% find that they are no longer interested in drugs after trying them again and are therefore clean after 6 months. This constitutes a 40% success rate, all from just a few-hour treatment of a little-known shrub from Western Africa. The other 35% are able to conquer their addiction with additional monthly Ibogaine treatments in conjunction with NA's programs, which is Narcotics Anonymous. The total success rate then becomes 75%, an absolutely outstanding and astounding result in the world of addiction. ACT UP comes bearing this study as well as research from Dr. Glick's team, showing that Ibogaine is not just a maintenance drug like methadone or Suboxone or Subutex. Yet in response, NIDA actually presents a plan for a phase of clinical trials within a year's time. But first, the Ibogaine team will have to redo the toxicity studies in rats. No one knows why. As Dr. Peter Hartsock later criticized, the strategy was basically to block Ibogaine by endlessly prolonging trials on rats and hoping for a failure at that stage so that things would never move forward to human research. Undoubtedly, this had to do with Big Pharma, the large pharmaceutical companies, and that maybe a medicine that could be made for a dollar and sold for 50 cents or a dollar or $1.50 or made for 25 cents could cure addiction in one treatment in a matter of a few hours, what would they do? They would lose billions of dollars a year in methadone, Suboxone, Subutex, which is just another addiction. Addicts that are put on methadone, Suboxone, or Subutex to this day are just trading one addiction for another addiction. Anyway, just as Ibogaine reaches peak levels of media attention, two conflicting studies come out. One study showed that Ibogaine was neurotoxic when injected into rats at 100 milligrams per kilogram. But of course, the standard dose for anti-addiction treatment is only 17 milligrams per kilogram in adults. And that is taken orally. An adult weighs 1,000 times more than a rat. But media reports don't often go into that kind of nuance or facts. Never let a good fact get in the way of the truth. Dr. Mash's results on monkeys show no cerebral toxicity, but unfortunately she was only able to conduct tests on 3 monkeys. Of course, the media latches onto the rat study, portraying Ibogaine as a controversial and dangerous treatment for addiction. Incredible. In 1994, the biggest defender of Ibogaine and ACT UP, Robert Reiger dies. Divisiveness reigns. The Ibogaine cause seems to compete with that of needle exchanges. ACT UP also faces stigma from other organizations, which accuse it of being a front organization for legalizing marijuana and Ibogaine. In the end, Reiger's death marks the death of an ACT UP supported Ibogaine movement as well. Meanwhile, things still look promising as NIDA meets with Ibogaine experts in May of 1994. All teams now agree that at therapeutic doses, Ibogaine is not neurotoxic. The FDA's Dr. Curtis Wright is satisfied, saying, "It sounds to me you folks have a phase one clinical trial." NIDA makes all the proposals for detailed clinical trials but sets no dates. In fact, the trials will never take place. The anti-Ibogaine militants take advantage of this new atmosphere. A last official meeting on Ibogaine takes place at NIDA. All Ibogaine experts agree that it is safe to move forward with Ibogaine trials in humans. All agreed. But Frank Voci, the conservative associate director at NIDA, brings in external consultants who have never worked in this area of Ibogaine. They don't even know what it is. They, of course, say they do not believe any treatment can act to break addiction. Based on what? We don't know. No one knows. No facts, no details, no trials, no clinical studies, no anything, but that's their opinion. The FDA would take a more liberal approach and did approve Dr. Masher's research in Miami, but in the end, the FDA has no influence over NIDA and the requests of Masher's team are denied. All legitimate research with Ibogaine has now ended. With this sharp right turn in U.S. drug policy, President Clinton is persuaded to crack down on marijuana use, and his drug czar calls Ibogaine a dangerous and addictive hallucinogen and a trick. What happened to Hillary's promise? Arising out of African rituals similar to sorcery, promoted by former hippies, ex-junkies, and African-American activists, and erroneously labeled as an hallucinogen, it's not. It's a psychoactive medicine. Ibogaine was laboring under a bad image, as much in terms of deserving to be taken seriously as from the standpoint of morality, even among scientists. There are many who don't want to even hear of Ibogaine, quite simply because that would mean admitting that non-scientists, and on top of that, actual drug users, had made an important discovery. To this day, if someone goes to an AA meeting or an NA meeting and tries to talk about Ibogaine, they're thrown out. Sometimes the people get violent even. They just don't want to listen. So in the end, Ibogaine was of no financial interest to anybody, and that's mostly what this came down to, as most things do. Political decision makers would have led to show enormous dedication to Ibogaine to bring it through legalization as a prescription medication through public sector funded research, as most drugs are done. And that was never going to happen. Ibogaine is a dangerous competitor to the commercial sector from anti-addiction treatments. What would happen, like I said before, the billions of dollars a day, a week, a year that are sold in Subutex, Suboxone, Methadone, NA, AA. In fact, the promoters of Methadone were the first to block Ibogaine's development. What a surprise. And Methadone is worse drug than heroin, more addictive, more dangerous. And it's just trading a heroin addiction for a methadone addiction, which is more difficult to get off of than heroin. When you're treated with Ibogaine, you must be off methadone for 6 weeks, maybe 2-3 months. So what does someone have to do? Switch back to heroin or a fast-acting opiate, something less strong and dangerous than methadone. Even certain scientists whose entire careers were based on methadone had fought Ibogaine research. There may be additional cultural factors at play as well here, though. In this morally conservative country, addicts are seen as guilty and deserve to pay for their mistakes. No one wants to be associated with an addict. Things are changing. Most countries have changed. But in the United States, it's still dirty to be an addict, and it's a stigma. It would almost be too soft a punishment allowing addicts to just be cured, especially by taking an hallucinogenic drug. Indeed, it would make a mockery of our drug laws to have a Schedule I drug turn out to be a lifesaver. Who cares if it's hallucinogenic? Who cares if you just stand on your head and spit wooden nickels? Who cares how you're cured? NA is a cult. AA is a cult. Yet people do, some do, get cured or not cured, but they refrain from the rest of their lives from using serious illegal street drugs and dangerous drugs. So who cares? And so I began Weights in the Wings. I guess Big Pharma cares. The dollar cares. Money cares. For modern medicine to approach it once more, some have worked illegally treating people with Ibogaine within the United States. Ibogaine clinics all over the world have popped up. It's been an explosion in places like Mexico and Costa Rica, where Ibogaine is in a gray area. It's considered legal, but it's not legal. It's not illegal, so it's okay. They continue to treat addicts, but often at a steep price and under dangerous conditions. They call themselves clinics, but they're just houses or worse. And there's little to no known medical care, medical treatment, hospitalization. Very dangerous. In all my years being around Ibogaine, 7 years now, I'm researching it. I've seen one clinic that was actually in a hospital and worked with a hospital. It was through a legal Iboga treatment center, they call it legal, that someone was kicked her 2-year ketamine addiction, which is very dangerous, and met many others who have kicked their habits as well. She was a writer. She wrote a lot of stories on Ibogaine. It's not a magic bullet. A person has to be willing to do the work themselves to stay clean, but it's a hope. In a world where there isn't much hope to be found or help. Underground psychedelic psychotherapists such as Leo Zeff, famous psychiatrist, and Myron Solaroff hear of Ibogaine and begin using it in treatments. But outside of this work, Ibogaine is practically unknown as heroin takes over the culture. Even though it was never widely known or used, and practically no recreational potential. Ibogaine is not a recreational drug. It's not addictive. It makes you nauseous. You usually vomit. It's not a fun experience. The psychoactive effects are very helpful, but the actual physical experience is not fun at all. Most people say they would never do it again unless they had to, and they don't. So even though it was never widely a known substance or never widely used and had no recreational potential, Ibogaine would be swept to Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act in 1968, along with all the other psychedelic drugs, meaning it was deemed to have no valid medical use of potential. And this time, going into the 1970s, it continued. Meanwhile, more and more researchers take the initiative to work on Ibogaine, and more articles on Ibogaine are published in 1992 than in all the previous years combined. Ibogaine all but disappears, however. No matter what, it just couldn't stay for that long. Howard Lotsoff ends up in prison and then addicted to opiates again, and Ibogaine is now unavailable to him, and he has to struggle to get clean on his own this time. It's in this context of the 1980s and 1990s that we finally see traction being made. Lotsoff makes an ally in marijuana legalization activist and Yippie member Dana Beale. With Dana Beale and Lotsoff's wife Nancy, Lotsoff founds the Staten Island Project to secretly dispense Ibogaine treatments. In 1 year, half the Yippies' expenditures secretly go towards funding these treatments. That fizzles out again, although Dana Beale continues this day to be an activist. Sadly, Lotsoff has passed away, although his wife Nancy is still active in the Ibogaine movement. Recently, in universities in New York, they've discovered Stanley Glick and some other scientists have worked on taking away the cardiotoxicity and hallucinogenic effects of Ibogaine, maybe to get the FDA to make it easier to approve. It's called 18MC. It's been so expensive to make, it's not practical, and they had to abandon those treatments and experiments. So that didn't work either. There's one little other thing. Ibogaine, as it relates to Parkinson's disease, There was a clinical study done on one patient, 70-year-old Parkinson's patient, and it seems that ibogaine was discovered many years ago to not produce dopamine, but to stimulate the glial cells that do produce dopamine. In effect, they would produce slightly more dopamine and slightly more and slightly more. And this person, we call him patient D, agreed to a clinical trial, came to Mexico, spent 30 days. And he started out on a very small dose, where an addict for heroin would get 1,000 to 1,500 or more milligrams at one time. The patient was given 4 milligrams only of ibogaine twice a day to start, then increased to 3 times a day, and then 4 times a day. It seems his motor functions improved, no tremors, his cognizant values improved, everything improved. He was able to dance, speak, regain clear thought, everything like a normal person without Parkinson's. This could be the biggest benefit of ibogaine. And yet again, although this is noted worldwide, it's on every social media site, published in articles and journals, nothing else has been done. To my knowledge, this person has been on ibogaine now for over 6 years. His dosage has increased, but he takes no other Parkinson's medications, and he's doing very well from what I understand. So from ibogaine being a one-time non-addictive treatment that can stop addiction in one treatment in a matter of hours, to basically reversing all the Parkinson's symptoms in one Parkinson's patient who's 70 years old, seems to be an incredible medicine, a natural medicine. What are we going to do about it? It's still being pushed. Vermont, the state, was trying to legalize it. Washington state was also trying to legalize it. It's a difficult situation when dealing with companies the size of the big pharmaceutical companies. But no one knows if it is still true. It's not a cure, but is it really an addiction interrupter? Is it psychological? Is it divisions? That's another strange thing about ibogaine. And it sounds spooky, it sounds crazy, but so many people have visions. They see dead relatives come and talk to them during a 6 to 8, 12 hour period. Questions get answered. But the strange thing is, thousands of people around the world, totally unrelated, why do they have the same, well, very close to the same visions or the same type of visions, the same type of reactions and experiences? No one knows. You should read and study up on ibogaine. It's all over the internet. Just be careful of the scams and phony reports and studies and the clinics, so-called clinics. They're not clinics. They're just providers. Ibogaine can also be dangerous. It can cause arrhythmia, and there's been many deaths during these non-clinical treatments. So it's something to be careful of. In my opinion, anything that works and has a 75% success rate, and although the true success rate seems to be more around 25% to 45%, which is still better than anything else known to man, I would give it a try. I would at least legalize it. If it was legalized in America, it would be done safely under medical conditions in hospitals and clinics with real doctors, real nurses, real equipment, and it could be purified even more. Well, time will tell, and we will see. In the meantime, research it, check it. Joe Rogan has many podcasts on ibogaine. He's done it himself. So until then, during this time of pandemic, COVID-19, be safe, be well, and God bless.